Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
In late 2018, a caravan of immigrants from Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras began a long journey north, seeking refuge from poverty and violence in their home countries. Most hoped they would make it to the United States border. According to the president, this is what they would find.
Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. But we will be doing things with Mexico, and they have to do it. Otherwise, I'm not going to do the NAFTA deal.
President Trump has built his political brand on a foundation of opposing some immigration. He says it is not the United States' job to take in refugees escaping dangerous places, even though the U.S. contributed to the dangerous situation they're trying to flee, including our Cold War strategies against communism in Central America, to our gun laws that make it easy for drug lords to obtain American firearms, to the U.S. demand for drugs. A new documentary from National Geographic called Blood on the Wall tracks the stories of migrants making their way with a large caravan toward the U.S. border. But it also tracks the history that created the conditions that made leaving home seem like the best option for so many Central and South Americans. Joining me now to talk about the film are filmmaker Sebastian Younger. Sebastian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
And Nick Quested. Nick, nice to meet you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sebastian, it's really interesting how you folks juxtapose three different angles here. The big picture story of the journeys of the migrants, the very close-up individual stories of two very different people, and then the history of the places from which people are fleeing and the U.S. involvement. Sebastian, what were you hoping to get across by showing these and interweaving these three storylines?
Well, my father was a refugee from two wars and an immigrant to this country. He married my mother, an American woman. And so I'm very sensitized to the issues of immigration and what this great country of ours is composed of. And, you know, I think what in this moment, this political moment a couple of years ago of a pretty rancorous debate about immigration, I think what we wanted to do, and certainly what I wanted to do personally, was to humanize the people we're talking about. We do need really sensible laws that govern immigration and protect national interests, but we need to create those laws in a context of understanding the basic humanity of everyone, and that if people are walking 1,000 miles to try to crawl under a fence to get into our country, they're probably pretty desperate, the way my father was when he left the Civil War in Spain as a child. So I think, you know, just personally, that's probably the main thing I would want people to come away with.
Nick, what was it like to be on the road with this caravan of people? And then ultimately, how did you decide which subjects to spend the most time with? Ooh, Nick, are you there? Let's see. Hi, Nick, can you hear me? Did we lose Nick? All right, we're going to try to get Nick back. Sebastian, you're up. the film.
Yeah, no worries.
The film takes a very close look at the drug trade, and it becomes clear that, you know, this idea about the border, that it's easier to get drugs over the border versus people who are in need over the border. What's the relationship between the drug trade and smuggling and the people, the need for people to leave? Can you just draw that direct line for us?
Well, the drug trade, the narco trade, has created an enormous amount of violence all throughout Mexico and Central America, and has empowered extremely violent gangs in the capitals of many of those countries. And so, of course, people flee. I mean, if you're a peaceful person and your children are in danger, you leave. And that's true of anybody in this country or otherwise. A lot of families fled New York City during COVID because they're primarily worried about their children. That really gets people motivated. So the drug trafficking and immigration are very tied together, and corruption is tied in with that. I mean, corruption is a common denominator in basically all of the world's ills: environmental degradation, violence, civil war, religious extremism. Corruption underlies all of those all those phenomena, and Mexico is incredibly corrupt. I should point out that the amount of drugs, I can't remember the figure offhand, but the amount of drugs that come into this country from Mexico over the border cannot possibly be brought on foot in people's backpacks. The drugs are coming in trucks, and they're coming in trucks partly because there are corrupt border border patrol officers on this side of the line, Americans, who are letting the trucks through, and they're getting paid. And so, I mean, just keep in mind, when I talk about corruption, it's not just a Mexican problem. It's equally an American problem, and it all feeds this terrible situation.
Nick, one of the refrains in the film is that you talk to people involved with the drug trade, and they are very matter-of-fact. They say, this is my job. This is how I'm going to put food. Oh, Nick's not there again? Okay. Well, I'll ask this to you, Sebastian. One of the refrains in the film is that, you know, people in the film talk about, this is my job. How else am I going to put food on the table for my family? We talk to poppy farmers, we see crystal meth producers, we see people who are shuttling the contraband across the border. I'm curious, what's your take, Sebastian? What do you think when you hear people say, you know, I know I have a specific role, but I need this job?
Yeah, I mean, you know, keep in mind that our moral responsibility as Americans includes the fact that we buy all these drugs. Billions and billions of dollars worth of drugs, and you know you cannot separate that reality from the decision that very, very poor, disempowered people make to grow it. That crop is valuable because we buy it, whether it's legal or not. We buy it. That makes it valuable. In Afghanistan, the growing poppy is a source of income for desperate families in one of the most impoverished countries in the world. People survive. We're crafty animals, right? I mean, the thing we do best is survive. The thing that is most compelling to us, really, is the survival of our children, to protect and feed our children. Any of us will do almost anything to make sure that that happens. So, to me, it's just a given that people in a desperately poor country will grow a kind of plant that's valuable next door. In the United States, that they'll do that to survive. It's just completely obvious. Like, that's not the problem. The problem is sort of further up the food chain, and that's where it has to be dealt with.
The name of the documentary is Blood on the Wall. I'm speaking with filmmakers Sebastian Younger and Nick Quested. So, Nick, I hope we have you back. I want to ask you, I'm going to circle back to the question I asked you before we lost you. What was it like to be on the road with this caravan of people trying to make their way north?
Well, I think that our experience in the caravan mimics the experience of the caravan. So at the beginning, it was this caravan of hope and expectation, and it was super powerful. And it was almost like you felt that you were in a political protest, like there were people demonstrating, and they were demonstrating by walking north. But as you got further through Mexico, the pressure on the caravan, both politically and from the news, became more and more, and they were in the end bussed to the border by Tijuana. And when they were on the border, you almost felt like they were abandoned. And for us, it was much harder. It was hot and cold at night, and you felt the hopelessness of the caravan. And they had to make a decision at that point whether they crossed into America to legally claim asylum or go home. So, and for us, it was much more dangerous as you got further north. So, I think that our experience mimicked the experience of the caravan, to paraphrase.
In the film, as I mentioned, you take the big picture story of people and migrants coming north, and then you follow two individuals, and they're very, very different. Nick, let me ask you about Sarah, who's coming from Guatemala with her family. She's with children. She's been on the road for more than 100 days. What was life like for Sarah that, to Sebastian's point, she felt like she needed to leave to protect her children?
Well, yeah, I mean, no one wants to leave their home, so you have to understand what daily life was like. You know, they're sleeping in the park, they're walking, or sometimes they would get a local taxi because the weather was too oppressive. So, life was very hard. You're dependent on food handouts from either the government or the local population. And I can't imagine being in that position. And what, as Sebastian said, we wanted people to understand who was actually on this caravan and what they were going through, because no one wants to leave their house. And you can, when people leave their house, you know it's because of something that's life-threatening, whether it's the climate change in the west of America, or look at what's happening in New York right now. There was an exodus of the people that could afford to leave New York during the pandemic. And the pandemic is nowhere near as deadly as the criminal violence that's happening in the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Sebastian, the other person we meet is Luthi, a Honduran migrant who we follow in the film, and she says she's young. She's very young, and she's charming, and she says she saw a caravan and decided to make a decision in the moment to join. How different was her journey, and how different is the decision for young people like Luthi and her friends?
Well, I mean, I'm going to hand this back to Nick in a moment, because he was on the ground, and I wasn't able to be. I was kicked out of Mexico some years ago for my reporting and couldn't go back. But she'd made the point that most young women in her country have been raped, and she was a victim of rape, a survivor of rape. And she realized that I think she was 15 or something, she was quite young, and she left with some of her peers. And it's a society of children, really, of teenagers, and on that caravan in some of these communities. And she had a very, I'll let Nick describe it because he was there, but she had a very, very complex journey, both geographically and I think as a person. Nick, do you want to jump in?
Well, no, absolutely. She's an adolescent, and it was an adventure to start with, and then the adventure became more and more real. So she's with her friends, and they're literally like treating it like an adventure. They're walking. It's hard, but it's exciting, and there's this sense of hope. But as this sense of hope eroded as she got further and further north, and in the end, her boyfriend who leaves her, and she, in desperation, used some drugs recreationally. I think that the Luthi's journey was very much representative of the caravan too. Like and it's a tragedy because she's now back in Honduras. She does have a baby, but she's living in a friend's room, and she's as vulnerable as she was before the caravan, but potentially more now because she has a baby.
One of the striking things, it's a piece of filmmaking, and there's no, obviously you couldn't have planned this, is the how her appearance changes over the course of the film.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's really stunning.
They also spent some time with the LGBTQ section of the caravan as minors, because they're sort of a group of others within the caravan, and as unaccompanied minors, they didn't have the large family units that were traveling together. So that became almost a family with people looking out for themselves. And you saw, her appearance change throughout the caravan, and that was a visual representation of her mindset.
I'm speaking with Sebastian Younger and Nick Quested about their documentary Blood on the Wall. It'll be on Nat Geo. We'll have more with them after a quick break. This is All of It. This is All of It. My guests are Sebastian Younger and Nick Quested. The name of their new documentary is Blood on the Wall. Sebastian, there's this feedback loop of corruption, violence, economics, migration, and it just swirls together. And you show that process play out most explicitly in Acapulco, which was this, amazing destination for tourism. Will you walk us through what happened in Acapulco?
Yeah, and Nick should jump in, too, because he's, like, really an expert on this. But basically, when they, the Mexican government decided to try to crack down on the drug cartels, they didn't fix the basic problems that gave rise to this incredibly lucrative industry. They sort of decapitated the main cartels, took out the leadership. And so, essentially, there was a power vacuum, and the sort of sub-lieutenants fell into wars with each other. And it impeded the flow of drugs. It impeded the business. And as resources dwindled, as revenue dwindled for them, you had basically standing armies of fairly violent young men who suddenly were not making any money. And keep in mind, these are not, I mean, you have to throw out sort of some of the Hollywood images of the lavish lifestyles of drug cartels. You know, most of the foot soldiers in these organizations are making very little money and come from desperately poor backgrounds. So these guys, all of a sudden, their revenue is dried up. And so they turn to other things to make ends meet, extortion, kidnapping, forcing companies to pay them each month so that in return for protection, you know, protection racket, that kind of things, and that kind of thing. And so Acapulco became a sort of dystopian nightmare, whereas some years ago, whatever, it was this paradise.
Nick, did you want to dive in?
Oh, no, that's absolutely the what happened. And you can see on the ground now in Acapulco has been divided up into 9 separate territories. And each of these territories is run by a different branch of what was Arturo Beltran Leyva's part of the Cartel de Sinaloa. And now you have different groups like Los Capuchinos or Las Cremas or Cartel Independiente de Acapulco, which is CIDA, which is, means AIDS in Spanish. And it's really incredible that you can be one block off the Costera, which is the sort of promenade there, and you're walking into a war zone where people don't change their table when someone is murdered 20 feet from them. They just keep on going. And it's completely normalized this level of extreme violence. And as Sebastian said, it's now parasitic. The gangs now are preying on the local populace for rent. And we filmed a fishmonger who was murdered over $10. Hmm. And we actually got there before the police got there because our local journalist that we were filming, Carlos Embruben, who worked for a newspaper there called El Sur, I ran up and started rushing in and tried to film, and they held me back. And I was like, but come on, it's right here. And they were like, no, wait a second. And I was like, what are you talking about? It's like, the police aren't here, which probably means that the guys that did this are still here. So let's just take a beat here a second, guys. So the point being is that these guys don't leave their communities. They are right there. And that is very, very frightening for the local populace.
I do want to play a clip from the film, because the film explores this relationship between police and crime lords and drug lords. So let's listen to Denise Dresser, a political analyst you included in the film, talking about what that relationship looks like to the people who live in these cartel-run areas. This is from Blood on the Wall.
The basic institutions of the Mexican state, the police, the courts, every day display the incompetence and politicization and corruption that makes them dysfunctional. This is a country where 98% of crimes are never solved. And what does this mean for an ordinary Mexican? That if you are the victim of a crime, the probability of there being some sort of rule of law solution to your issue will not happen.
So, Sebastian, how do these cartels take these institutions that are supposed to pursue justice and turn them into allies?
Well, the way that they do in any country, they buy them off and they threaten
money.
Them. They threaten to kill them, they threaten them with consequences, and they pay them a lot of money. And that can happen in absolutely any country. And even political retribution can sway people's can sway people's actions. And we're, you know, obviously we're starting to see the beginnings of that process in this country. And, you know, I think that's the there's a tipping point where the majority of people and the majority of people in government suddenly no longer believe in the institutions themselves and retreat into their own narrow self-interest because they don't think that there's any cohesive organization or philosophy looking out after everybody. And when that happens, it's sort of every person for themselves, and that's the beginning of the end of a democracy.
Nick, the film clearly explains the U.S. role in all of this, not just the destination, but also as an active participant in helping to create this crisis, from the hunger and the thirst for drugs to the fact that we sell 90% of guns seized in Mexico by Mexican authorities can be traced back to the U.S. in origin. I'm assuming you knew a lot about this before going into this process, but what is something that you discovered in the course of making this film about the U.S. involvement that really did surprise you?
I mean, I think the extent of the legacy of, you know, the Cold War still being reflected in the politics of today is was surprising. We're talking, you know, the turning a blind eye to, you know, large-scale importation of cocaine to America for political goals, and I never really saw cocaine as a political tool in the way that I do now.
Sebastian, how about for you?
You know, I think I would circle back to the way we started this conversation. I'm amazed at the courage and determination of people who are fleeing a threat to their lives and the safety of their children. I mean, they will do anything, and we sort of know that. We all know that in the abstract, but a lot of people in the United States, like myself, are lucky to live in communities that are where they're not subjected to daily violence necessarily, and they can count on the fact that they'll eat tomorrow. Not all of Americans, but probably a majority. And we forget that we forget how bad things can get and how strong people can be when they need to be. And it's a very complicated decision who to let into this country and who not to. Very complicated. There's no easy answers. But we should not delude ourselves that the people who want to come in through the Mexican border, through any port of entry, that they're sort of predatory on our affluence. They're not. Most of them are really desperate, and we would, if we were coming from where they were coming from, we would be them. We really mustn't forget that.
The name of the film is Blood on the Wall. It'll be on National Geographic, I believe, on September 30th is when it debuts. Sebastian Younger, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Nick Quested, thank you as well.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.